anything else if he does not take pains to have it. Yet he will not give to the wrong people, nor at the wrong time, and so on, for he would no longer be acting in accordance with liberality. And if he spent on these objects, he would have nothing to spend on the right objects. For, as has been said, he is liberal who spends according to his substance and on the right objects, and he who exceeds is prodigal. Hence we do not call despots prodigal. For it is thought not easy for them to give and spend beyond the amount of their possessions. Liberality, then, being a mean with regard to giving and taking of wealth, the liberal man will both give and spend the right amounts and on the right objects, alike in small things and in great, and that with pleasure. He will also take the right amounts and from the right sources, for, the virtue being a mean with regard to both, he will do both as he ought. Since this sort of taking accompanies proper giving, and that which is not of this sort is contrary to it, and accordingly the giving and taking that accompany each other are present together in the same man, while the contrary kinds evidently are not. But if he happens to spend in a manner contrary to what is right and noble, he will be pained, but moderately and as he ought. For it is the mark of virtue both to be pleased and to be pained at the right objects and in the right way. Further, the liberal man is easy to deal with in money matters, for he can be got the better of, since he sets no store by money, and is more annoyed if he has not spent something that he ought than pained if he has spent something that he ought not, and does not agree with the saying of Simonides. The prodigal errs in these respects also. For he is neither pleased nor pained at the right things or in the right way. This will be more evident as we go on. We have said that prodigality and meanness are excesses and deficiencies, and in two things, in giving and in taking, for we include spending under giving. Now prodigality exceeds in giving and not taking, while meanness falls short in giving and exceeds in taking, except in small things. The characteristics of prodigality are not often combined, for it is not easy to give to all if you take from none. Private persons soon exhaust their substance with giving, and it is to these that the name of prodigals is applied, though a man of this sort would seem to be in no small degree better than a mean man, for he is easily cured both by age and by poverty, and thus he may move towards the middle state. For he has the characteristics of the liberal man, since he both gives and refrains from taking, though he does neither of these in the right manner or well. Therefore, if he were brought to do so by habituation or in some other way, he would be liberal, for he will then give to the right people and will not take from the wrong sources. This is why he is thought to have not a bad character. It is not the mark of a wicked or ignoble man to go to excess in giving and not taking, but only of a foolish one. The man who is prodigal in this way is thought much better than the mean man, both for the aforesaid reasons, and because he benefits many while the other benefits no one, not even himself. But most prodigal people, as has been said, also take from the wrong sources, and are in this respect mean. They become apt to take because they wish to spend and cannot do this easily, for their possessions soon run short. Thus they are forced to provide means from some other source. At the same time, because they care nothing for honour, they take recklessly and from any source, for they have an appetite for giving, and they do not mind how or from what source. Hence also their giving is not liberal, for it is not noble, nor does it aim at nobility, nor is it done in the right way. Sometimes they make rich those who should be poor, and will give nothing to people of respectable character, and much to flatterers, or those who provide them with some other pleasure, Hence also, most of them are self-indulgent, for they spend lightly and waste money on their indulgences, and incline towards pleasures because they do not live with a view to what is noble. The prodigal man, then, turns into what we have described if he is left untutored. But if he is treated with care, he will arrive at the intermediate and right state. But meanness is both incurable, for old age and every disability is thought to make men mean, and more innate in men than prodigality. For most men are fonder of getting money than of giving. It also extends widely and is multiform, since there seem to be many kinds of meanness. For it consists in two things: deficiency in giving and excess in taking, and is not found complete in all men, but is sometimes divided. Some men go to excess in taking, others fall short in giving. Those who are called by such names as miserly, close, stingy, all fall short in giving, but do not covet the possessions of others nor wish to get them. In some this is due to a sort of honesty and avoidance of what is disgraceful, for some seem, or at least profess, to hoard their money for this reason, that they may not some day be forced to do something disgraceful. To this class belong the cheese parer and every one of the sort. He is so called from his excess of unwillingness to give anything, while others again keep their hands off the property of others from fear, on the ground that it is not easy, if one takes the property of others oneself, to avoid having one's own taken by them. They are therefore content neither to take nor to give. Others again exceed in respect of taking by taking anything and from any source, e.g. those who ply sordid trades, pimps, and all such people, and those who lend small sums and at high rates. For all of these take more than they ought, and from wrong sources. What is common to them is evidently sordid love of gain. They all put up with a bad name for the sake of gain, and little gain at that. For those who make great gains, but from wrong sources, and not the right gains, e.g. despots when they sack cities and spoil temples, we do not call mean, but rather wicked, impious, and unjust. But the gamester, and the footpad, and the highwayman belong to the class of the mean, since they have a sordid love of gain. For it is for gain that both of them ply their craft, and endure the disgrace of it. And the one faces the greatest dangers for the sake of the booty, while the other makes gain from his friends, to whom he ought to be giving. Both, then, since they are willing to make gain from wrong sources, are sordid lovers of gain. Therefore all such forms of taking are mean. And it is natural that meanness is described as the contrary of liberality, for not only is it a greater evil than prodigality, but men err more often in this direction than in the way of prodigality as we have described it. So much, then, for liberality and the opposed vices. 2. It would seem proper to discuss magnificence next, for this also seems to be a virtue concerned with wealth. But it does not, like liberality, extend to all the actions that are concerned with wealth, but only to those that involve expenditure, and in these it surpasses liberality in scale. For as the name itself suggests, it is a fitting expenditure involving largeness of scale. But the scale is relative, for the expense of equipping a trireme is not the same as that of heading a sacred assembly. It is what is fitting, then, in relation to the agent, and to the circumstances, and the object. The man who in small or middling things spends according to the merits of the case is not called magnificent, e.g. the man who can say, "Many a gift I gave the wanderer." but only the man who does so in great things. For the magnificent man is liberal, but the liberal man is not necessarily magnificent. The deficiency of this state of character is called niggardliness, the excess vulgarity, lack of taste, and the like, which do not go to excess in the amount spent on right objects, but by showy expenditure in the wrong circumstances and the wrong manner. We shall speak of these vices later. The magnificent man is like an artist, for he can see what is fitting and spend large sums tastefully. For, as we said at the beginning, a state of character is determined by its activities and by its objects. Now the expenses of the magnificent man are large and fitting, such, therefore, are also his results. For thus there will be a great expenditure, and one that is fitting to its result. Therefore the result should be worthy of the expense, and the expense should be worthy of the result, or should even exceed it. And the magnificent man will spend such sums for honour's sake, for this is common to the virtues. And further, he will do so gladly and lavishly, for nice calculation is a niggardly thing, and he will consider how the result can be made most beautiful and most becoming, rather than for how much it can be produced and how it can be produced most cheaply. It is necessary, then, that the magnificent man be also liberal. For the liberal man also will spend what he ought and as he ought. And it is in these matters that the greatness implied in the name of the magnificent man, his bigness, as it were, is manifested, since liberality is concerned with these matters. And at an equal expense, he will produce a more magnificent work of art. For a possession and a work of art have not the same excellence. The most valuable possession is that which is worth most, e.g., gold. But the most valuable work of art is that which is great and beautiful, for the contemplation of such a work inspires admiration, and so does magnificence. And a work has an excellence, viz., magnificence which involves magnitude. Magnificence is an attribute of expenditures of the kind which we call honourable, e.g., those connected with the gods, votive offerings, buildings and sacrifices, and similarly with any form of religious worship, and all those that are proper objects of public-spirited ambition, as when people think they ought to equip a chorus or a trireme or entertain the city in a brilliant way. But in all cases, as has been said, we have regard to the agent as well, and ask who he is and what means he has, for the expenditure should be worthy of his means, and suit not only the result, but also the producer. Hence a poor man cannot be magnificent, since he has not the means with which to spend large sums fittingly, and he who tries is a fool, since he spends beyond what can be expected of him and what is proper. But it is right expenditure that is virtuous. But great expenditure is becoming to those who have suitable means to start with, acquired by their own efforts or from ancestors or connections, and to people of high birth or reputation and so on, for all these things bring with them greatness and prestige. Primarily, then, the magnificent man is of this sort, and magnificence is shown in expenditures of this sort, as has been said, for these are the greatest and most honourable. Of private occasions of expenditure, the most suitable are those that take place once for all, e.g. a wedding or anything of the kind, or anything that interests the whole city or the people of position in it, and also the receiving of foreign guests and the sending of them on their way, and gifts and counter-gifts. For the magnificent man spends not on himself, but on public objects, and gifts bear some resemblance to votive offerings. A magnificent man will also furnish his house suitably to his wealth, for even a house is a sort of public ornament, and will spend by preference on those works that are lasting, for these are the most beautiful. And on every class of things he will spend what is becoming, for the same things are not suitable for gods and for men, nor in a temple and in a tomb. And since each expenditure may be great of its kind, and what is most magnificent absolutely is great expenditure on a great object, but what is magnificent here is what is great in these circumstances, and greatness in the work differs from greatness in the expense. For the most beautiful ball or bottle is magnificent as a gift to a child, but the price of it is small and mean. Therefore, it is characteristic of the magnificent man, whatever kind of result he is producing, to produce it magnificently, for such a result is not easily surpassed, and to make it worthy of the expenditure. Such, then, is the magnificent man. The man who goes to excess, and is vulgar, exceeds, as has been said, by spending beyond what is right. For on small objects of expenditure he spends much and displays a tasteless showiness, e.g. he gives a club dinner on the scale of a wedding banquet, and when he provides the chorus for a comedy he brings them on to the stage in purple, as they do at Megara. And all such things he will do not for honour's sake, but to show off his wealth, and because he thinks he is admired for these things, and where he ought to spend much, he spends little, and where little, much. The niggardly man, on the other hand, will fall short in everything, and after spending the greatest sums, will spoil the beauty of the result for a trifle. And whatever he is doing, he will hesitate and consider how he may spend least, and lament even that, and think he is doing everything on a bigger scale than he ought. These states of character, then, are vices. Yet they do not bring disgrace, because they are neither harmful to one's neighbour, nor very unseemly. 3. Pride seems even from its name to be concerned with great things. What sort of great things is the first question we must try to answer. It makes no difference whether we consider the state of character or the man characterized by it. Now the man is thought to be proud who thinks himself worthy of great things, being worthy of them. For he who does so, beyond his deserts, is a fool. But no virtuous man is foolish or silly. The proud man, then, is the man we have described. For he who is worthy of little and thinks himself worthy of little is temperate, but not proud, for pride implies greatness, as beauty implies a good-sized body, and little people may be neat and well-proportioned, but cannot be beautiful. On the other hand, he who thinks himself worthy of great things, being unworthy of them, is vain. Though not everyone who thinks himself worthy of more than he really is worthy of is vain. The man who thinks himself worthy of less than he is really worthy of is unduly humble, whether his deserts be great or moderate, or his deserts be small, but his claims yet smaller, and the man whose deserts are great would seem most unduly humble. For what would he have done if they had been less? The proud man, then, is an extreme in respect of the greatness of his claims, but a mean in respect of the rightness of them. For he claims what is in accordance with his merits, while the others go to excess or fall short. If, then, he deserves and claims great things, and above all the great things, he will be concerned with one thing in particular. Desert is relative to external goods, and the greatest of these, we should say, is that which we render to the gods, and which people of position most aim at, and which is the prize appointed for the noblest deeds. And this is honour, that is surely the greatest of external goods. Honours and dishonours, therefore, are the objects with respect to which the proud man is as he should be. And even apart from argument, it is with honour that proud men appear to be concerned, for it is honour that they chiefly claim, but in accordance with their deserts. The unduly humble man falls short, both in comparison with his own merits and in comparison with the proud man's claims. The vain man goes to excess in comparison with his own merits, but does not exceed the proud man's claims. Now the proud man, since he deserves most, must be good in the highest degree. For the better man always deserves more, and the best man most. Therefore the truly proud man must be good. And greatness in every virtue would seem to be characteristic of a proud man, and it would be most unbecoming for a proud man to fly from danger swinging his arms by his sides, or to wrong another. For to what end should he do disgraceful acts, he to whom nothing is great? If we consider him point by point, we shall see the utter absurdity of a proud man who is not good. Nor, again, would he be worthy of honour if he were bad, for honour is the prize of virtue, and it is to the good that it is rendered. Pride, then, seems to be a sort of crown of the virtues, for it makes them greater, and it is not found without them. Therefore it is hard to be truly proud, for it is impossible without nobility and goodness of character. It is chiefly with honours and dishonours, then, that the proud man is concerned, and at honours that are great and conferred by good men, he will be moderately pleased, thinking that he is coming by his own, or even less than his own. For there can be no honour that is worthy of perfect virtue. Yet he will at any rate accept it, since they have nothing greater to bestow on him, but honour from casual people, and on trifling grounds he will utterly despise, since it is not this that he deserves, and dishonour too, since in his case it cannot be just. In the first place, then, as has been said, the proud man is concerned with honours. Yet he will also bear himself with moderation towards wealth and power, and all good or evil fortune, whatever may befall him, and will be neither overjoyed by good fortune nor overpained by evil. For not even towards honour does he bear himself, as if it were a very great thing. Power and wealth are desirable for the sake of honour. At least, those who have them wish to get honour by means of them. And for him to whom even honour is a little thing, the others must be so too. Hence proud men are thought to be disdainful. The goods of fortune also are thought to contribute towards pride. For men who are well born are thought worthy of honour, and so are those who enjoy power or wealth, for they are in a superior position, and everything that has a superiority in something good is held in greater honour. Hence even such things make men prouder, for they are honoured by some for having them. But in truth, the good man alone is to be honoured. He, however, who has both advantages, is thought the more worthy of honour. But those who without virtue have such goods are neither justified in making great claims, nor entitled to the name of proud. For these things imply perfect virtue. Disdainful and insolent, however, even those who have such goods become. For without virtue it is not easy to bear gracefully the goods of fortune, and being unable to bear them, and thinking themselves superior to others, they despise others, and themselves do what they please. They imitate the proud man without being like him, and this they do where they can. So they do not act virtuously, but they do despise others. For the proud man despises justly, since he thinks truly, but the many do so at random. He does not run into trifling dangers, nor is he fond of danger, because he honours few things. But he will face great dangers, and when he is in danger he is unsparing of his life, knowing that there are conditions on which life is not worth having. And he is the sort of man to confer benefits, but he is ashamed of receiving them, for the one is the mark of a superior, the other of an inferior. and he is apt to confer greater benefits in return. For thus the original benefactor, besides being paid, will incur a debt to him, and will be the gainer by the transaction. They seem also to remember any service they have done, but not those they have received, for he who receives a service is inferior to him who has done it, but the proud man wishes to be superior, and to hear of the former with pleasure, of the latter with displeasure. This, it seems, is why Thetis did not mention to Zeus the services she had done him, and why the Spartans did not recount their services to the Athenians, but those they had received. It is a mark of the proud man also to ask for nothing, or scarcely anything, but to give help readily, and to be dignified towards people who enjoy high position and good fortune, but unassuming towards those of the middle class. For it is a difficult and lofty thing to be superior to the former, but easy to be so to the latter. And a lofty bearing over the former is no mark of ill-breeding, but among humble people it is as vulgar as a display of strength against the weak. Again, it is characteristic of the proud man not to aim at the things commonly held in honour or the things in which others excel, to be sluggish and to hold back except where great honour or a great work is at stake, and to be a man of few deeds, but of great and notable ones. He must also be open in his hate and in his love. For to conceal one's feelings, i.e. to care less for truth than for what people will think, is a coward's part. And must speak and act openly. For he is free of speech because he is contemptuous, and he is given to telling the truth, except when he speaks in irony to the vulgar. He must be unable to make his life revolve round another, unless it be a friend, for this is slavish. And for this reason all flatterers are servile, and people lacking in self-respect are flatterers. Nor is he given to admiration, for nothing to him is great. Nor is he mindful of wrongs, for it is not the part of a proud man to have a long memory, especially for wrongs, but rather to overlook them. Nor is he a gossip, for he will speak neither about himself nor about another, since he cares not to be praised, nor for others to be blamed. Nor again is he given to praise, and for the same reason he is not an evil speaker, even about his enemies, except from haughtiness. With regard to necessary or small matters, he is least of all given to lamentation or the asking of favours. For it is the part of one who takes such matters seriously to behave so with respect to them. He is one who will possess beautiful and profitless things rather than profitable and useful ones. For this is more proper to a character that suffices to itself. Further, a slow step is thought proper to the proud man, a deep voice and a level utterance, for the man who takes few things seriously is not likely to be hurried, nor the man who thinks nothing great to be excited, while a shrill voice and a rapid gait are the results of hurry and excitement. Such, then, is the proud man. The man who falls short of him is unduly humble, and the man who goes beyond him is vain. Now even these are not thought to be bad, for they are not malicious, but only mistaken. For the unduly humble man, being worthy of good things, robs himself of what he deserves, and to have something bad about him from the fact that he does not think himself worthy of good things, and seems also not to know himself, else he would have desired the things he was worthy of, since these were good. Yet such people are not thought to be fools, but rather unduly retiring. Such a reputation, however, seems actually to make them worse. For each class of people aims at what corresponds to its worth, and these people stand back even from noble actions and undertakings, deeming themselves unworthy, and from external goods no less. Vain people, on the other hand, are fools and ignorant of themselves, and that manifestly. For, not being worthy of them, they attempt honourable undertakings, and then are found out. And they adorn themselves with clothing and outward show and such things, and wish their strokes of good fortune to be made public, and speak about them, as if they would be honoured for them. But undue humility is more opposed to pride than vanity is, for it is both commoner and worse. Pride, then, is concerned with honour on the grand scale, as has been said. 4. There seems to be in the sphere of honour also, as was said in our first remarks on the subject, a virtue which would appear to be related to pride as liberality is to magnificence. For neither of these has anything to do with the grand scale, but both dispose us, as is right, with regard to middling and unimportant objects. As in getting and giving of wealth, there is a mean and an excess and defect. So too, honour may be desired more than is right, or less, or from the right sources and in the right way. We blame both the ambitious man, as aiming at honour more than is right, and from wrong sources, and the unambitious man as not willing to be honoured, even for noble reasons. But sometimes we praise the ambitious man as being manly and a lover of what is noble, and the unambitious man as being moderate and self-controlled, as we said in our first treatment of the subject. Evidently, since fond of such and such an object has more than one meaning, we do not assign the term ambition or love of honour always to the same thing. But when we praise the quality, we think of the man who loves honour more than most people, and when we blame it, we think of him who loves it more than is right. The mean being without a name, the extremes seem to dispute for its place, as though that were vacant by default. But where there is excess and defect, there is also an intermediate. Now men desire honour both more than they should and less. Therefore it is possible also to do so as one should. At all events, this is the state of character that is praised, being an unnamed mean in respect of honour. Relatively to ambition, it seems to be unambitiousness, and relatively to unambitiousness, it seems to be ambition, while relatively to both severally, it seems in a sense to be both together. This appears to be true of the other virtues also. But in this case, the extremes seem to be contradictories because the mean has not received a name. 5. Good temper is a mean with respect to anger, the middle state being unnamed, and the extremes almost without a name as well. We place good temper in the middle position, though it inclines towards the deficiency which is without a name. The excess might be called a sort of irascibility, for the passion is anger, while its causes are many and diverse. The man who is angry at the right things and with the right people and further as he ought, when he ought, and as long as he ought, is praised. This will be the good-tempered man, then, since good temper is praised. For the good-tempered man tends to be unperturbed and not to be led by passion, but to be angry in the manner, at the things, and for the length of time that the rule dictates. But he is thought to err rather in the direction of deficiency, for the good-tempered man is not revengeful, but rather tends to make allowances. The deficiency, whether it is a sort of inirascibility or whatever it is blamed. For those who are not angry at the things they should be angry at are thought to be fools. And so are those who are not angry in the right way, at the right time, or with the right persons. For such a man is thought not to feel things nor to be pained by them, and since he does not get angry, he is thought unlikely to defend himself, and to endure being insulted, and put up with insult to one's friends, is slavish. The excess can be manifested in all the points that have been named, for one can be angry with the wrong persons at the wrong things, more than is right too quickly or too long. Yet all are not found in the same person. Indeed they could not, for evil destroys even itself, and if it is complete, becomes unbearable. Now hot-tempered people get angry quickly and with the wrong persons and at the wrong things, and more than is right, but their anger ceases quickly, which is the best point about them. This happens to them because they do not restrain their anger, but retaliate openly owing to their quickness of temper, and then their anger ceases. By reason of excess choleric, people are quick-tempered and ready to be angry with everything and on every occasion, whence their name. Sulky people are hard to appease, and retain their anger long, for they repress their passion. But it ceases when they retaliate, for revenge relieves them of their anger, producing in them pleasure instead of pain. If this does not happen, they retain their burden, for owing to its not being obvious, no one even reasons with them, and to digest one's anger in oneself takes time. Such people are most troublesome to themselves and to their dearest friends. We call bad-tempered those who are angry at the wrong things, more than is right, and longer, and cannot be appeased until they inflict vengeance or punishment. To good temper, we oppose the excess rather than the defect. For not only is it commoner, since revenge is the more human, but bad-tempered people are worse to live with. What we have said in our earlier treatment of the subject is plain also from what we are now saying, viz., that it is not easy to define how, with whom, at what, and how long one should be angry, and at what point right action ceases and wrong begins. For the man who strays a little from the path, either towards the more or towards the less, is not blamed, since sometimes we praise those who exhibit the deficiency and call them good-tempered, and sometimes we call angry people manly, as being capable of ruling. How far, therefore, and how a man must stray before he becomes blameworthy? It is not easy to state in words, for the decision depends on the particular facts and on perception. But so much at least is plain, that the middle state is praiseworthy, that in virtue of which we are angry with the right people, at the right things, in the right way, and so on, while the excesses and defects are blameworthy, slightly so if they are present in a low degree, more if in a higher degree, and very much if in a high degree. Evidently, then, we must cling to the middle state. Enough of the states relative to anger. 6. In gatherings of men, in social life, and the interchange of words and deeds, some men are thought to be obsequious, viz., those who to give pleasure praise everything, and never oppose, but think it their duty to give no pain to the people they meet, while those who, on the contrary, oppose everything and care not a whit about giving pain are called churlish and contentious. That the states we have named are culpable is plain enough, and that the middle state is laudable, that in virtue of which a man will put up with and will resent the right things and in the right way, but no name has been assigned to it, though it most resembles friendship. For the man who corresponds to this middle state is very much what, with affection added, we call a good friend. But the state in question differs from friendship in that it implies no passion or affection for one's associates, since it is not by reason of loving or hating that such a man takes everything in the right way, but by being a man of a certain kind. For he will behave so alike towards those he knows and those he does not know, towards intimates and those who are not so, except that in each of these cases he will behave as is befitting, for it is not proper to have the same care for intimates and for strangers, nor again is it the same conditions that make it right to give pain to them. Now we have said generally that he will associate with people in the right way, but it is by reference to what is honourable and expedient that he will aim at not giving pain or at contributing pleasure. for he seems to be concerned with the pleasures and pains of social life, and wherever it is not honourable or is harmful for him to contribute pleasure, he will refuse and will choose rather to give pain. Also, if his acquiescence in another's action would bring disgrace, and that in a high degree or injury on that other, while his opposition brings a little pain, he will not acquiesce but will decline. He will associate differently with people in high station and with ordinary people, with closer and more distant acquaintances, and so too with regard to all other differences, rendering to each class what is befitting. And while for its own sake he chooses to contribute pleasure and avoids the giving of pain, he will be guided by the consequences, if these are greater, i.e., honour and expediency. For the sake of a great future pleasure, too, he will inflict small pains. The man who attains the mean, then, is such as we have described, but has not received a name. Of those who contribute pleasure, the man who aims at being pleasant with no ulterior object is obsequious. But the man who does so in order that he may get some advantage in the direction of money or the things that money buys is a flatterer, while the man who quarrels with everything is, as has been said, churlish and contentious. And the extremes seem to be contradictory to each other, because the mean is without a name. 7. The mean opposed to boastfulness is found in almost the same sphere, and this also is without a name. It will be no bad plan to describe these states as well, for we shall both know the facts about character better if we go through them in detail, and we shall be convinced that the virtues are means if we see this to be so in all cases. In the field of social life, those who make the giving of pleasure or pain their object in associating with others have been described. Let us now describe those who pursue truth or falsehood alike in words and deeds and in the claims they put forward. The boastful man, then, is thought to be apt to claim the things that bring glory when he has not got them, or to claim more of them than he has. And the mock modest man, on the other hand, to disclaim what he has or belittle it. While the man who observes the mean is one who calls a thing by its own name, being truthful both in life and in word, owning to what he has, and neither more nor less. Now each of these courses may be adopted either with or without an object, but each man speaks and acts and lives in accordance with his character, if he is not acting for some ulterior object. And falsehood is in itself mean and culpable, and truth noble and worthy of praise. Thus the truthful man is another case of a man who, being in the mean, is worthy of praise, and both forms of untruthful man are culpable, and particularly the boastful man. Let us discuss them both. But first of all, the truthful man. We are not speaking of the man who keeps faith in his agreements, i.e., in the things that pertain to justice or injustice, for this would belong to another virtue, but the man who, in the matters in which nothing of this sort is at stake, is true both in word and in life, because his character is such. But such a man would seem to be, as a matter of fact, equitable. For the man who loves truth and is truthful where nothing is at stake will still more be truthful when something is at stake. He will avoid falsehood as something base, seeing that he avoided it even for its own sake, and such a man is worthy of praise. He inclines rather to understate the truth, for this seems in better taste, because exaggerations are wearisome. He who claims more than he has with no ulterior object is a contemptible sort of fellow. Otherwise he would not have delighted in falsehood, but seems futile rather than bad. But if he does it for an object, He who does it for the sake of reputation or honour is, for a boaster, not very much to be blamed. But he who does it for money, or the things that lead to money, is an uglier character. It is not the capacity that makes the boaster, but the purpose. For it is in virtue of his state of character, and by being a man of a certain kind, that he is a boaster, as one man is a liar because he enjoys the lie itself, and another because he desires reputation or gain. Now those who boast for the sake of reputation claim such qualities as will praise or congratulation. But those whose object is gain claim qualities which are of value to one's neighbours and one's lack of which is not easily detected, e.g. the powers of a seer, a sage, or a physician. For this reason, it is such things as these that most people claim and boast about, for in them the above-mentioned qualities are found. Mock modest people who understate things seem more attractive in character, for they are thought to speak not for gain, but to avoid parade. And here too it is qualities which bring reputation that they disclaim, as Socrates used to do. Those who disclaim trifling and obvious qualities are called humbugs, and are more contemptible, and sometimes this seems to be boastfulness, like the Spartan dress. For both excess and great deficiency are boastful. But those who use understatement with moderation, and understate about matters that do not very much force themselves on our notice, seem attractive. And it is the boaster that seems to be opposed to the truthful man, for he is the worse character. 8. Since life includes rest as well as activity, and in this is included leisure and amusement, there seems here also to be a kind of intercourse which is tasteful. There is such a thing as saying, and again listening to, what one should and as one should. The kind of people one is speaking or listening to will also make a difference. Evidently, here also there is both an excess and a deficiency as compared with the mean. Those who carry humour to excess are thought to be vulgar buffoons, striving after humour at all costs and aiming rather at raising a laugh than at saying what is becoming and at avoiding pain to the object of their fun. While those who can neither make a joke themselves nor put up with those who do are thought to be boorish and unpolished. But those who joke in a tasteful way are called ready-witted, which implies a sort of readiness to turn this way and that, for such sallies are thought to be movements of the character, and as bodies are discriminated by their movements, so too are characters. The ridiculous side of things is not far to seek, however, and most people delight more than they should in amusement and in jestingly. And so even buffoons are called ready-witted because they are found attractive. But that they differ from the ready-witted man, and to no small extent, is clear from what has been said. To the middle state belongs also tact. It is the mark of a tactful man to say and listen to such things as befit a good and well-bred man, for there are some things that it befits such a man to say and to hear by way of jest. And the well-bred man's jesting differs from that of a vulgar man, and the joking of an educated man from that of an uneducated. One may see this even from the old and the new comedies. To the authors of the former, indecency of language was amusing. To those of the latter, innuendo is more so. And these differ in no small degree in respect of propriety. Now, should we define the man who jokes well by his saying what is not unbecoming to a well-bred man, or by his not giving pain, or even giving delight to the hearer? Or is the latter definition, at any rate, itself indefinite, since different things are hateful or pleasant to different people? The kind of jokes he will listen to will be the same, for the kind he can put up with are also the kind he seems to make. There are, then, jokes he will not make, for the jest is a sort of abuse, and there are things that lawgivers forbid us to abuse, and they should perhaps have forbidden us even to make a jest of such. The refined and well-bred man, therefore, will be as we have described, being, as it were, a law to himself. Such, then, is the man who observes the mean, whether he be called tactful or ready-witted. The buffoon, on the other hand, is the slave of his sense of humour, and spares neither himself nor others if he can raise a laugh, and says things none of which a man of refinement would say, and to some of which he would not even listen. The boor, again, is useless for such social intercourse, for he contributes nothing and finds fault with everything. But relaxation and amusement are thought to be a necessary element in life. The means in life that have been described, then, are three in number, and are all concerned with an interchange of words and deeds of some kind. They differ, however, in that one is concerned with truth, and the other two with pleasantness. Of those concerned with pleasure, one is displayed in jests, the other in the general social intercourse of life. 9. Shame should not be described as a virtue, for it is more like a feeling than a state of character. It is defined, at any rate, as a kind of fear of dishonour, and produces an effect similar to that produced by fear of danger. For people who feel disgraced blush, and those who fear death turn pale. Both, therefore, seem to be in a sense bodily conditions, which is thought to be characteristic of feeling rather than of a state of character. The feeling is not becoming to every age, but only to youth. For we think young people should be prone to the feeling of shame because they live by feeling and therefore commit many errors, but are restrained by shame. And we praise young people who are prone to this feeling, but an older person no one would praise for being prone to the sense of disgrace, since we think he should not do anything that need cause this sense. For the sense of disgrace is not even characteristic of a good man, since it is consequent on bad actions. For such actions should not be done, and if some actions are disgraceful in very truth, and others only according to common opinion, this makes no difference. For neither class of actions should be done, so that no disgrace should be felt. And it is a mark of a bad man even to be such as to do any disgraceful action. To be so constituted as to feel disgraced, if one does such an action, and for this reason to think oneself good, is absurd. For it is for voluntary actions that shame is felt. And the good man will never voluntarily do bad actions. But shame may be said to be conditionally a good thing. If a good man does such actions, he will feel disgraced. But the virtues are not subject to such a qualification. And if shamelessness, not to be ashamed of doing base actions, is bad, that does not make it good to be ashamed of doing such actions. Continence, too, is not virtue, but a mixed sort of state. This will be shown later. Now, however, let us discuss justice. Book 5. 1. With regard to justice and injustice, we must first consider what kind of actions they are concerned with, second, what sort of mean justice is, and third, between what extremes the just act is intermediate. Our investigation shall follow the same course as the preceding discussions. We see that all men mean by justice that kind of state of character which makes people disposed to do what is just, and makes them act justly and wish for what is just, and similarly, by injustice, that state which makes them act unjustly and wish for what is unjust. Let us too, then, lay this down as a general basis, for the same is not true of the sciences and the faculties as of states of character. A faculty or a science which is one and the same is held to relate to contrary objects. But a state of character, which is one of two contraries, does not produce the contrary results. E.g., as a result of health, we do not do what is the opposite of healthy, but only what is healthy. For we say a man walks healthily when he walks as a healthy man would. Now often, one contrary state is recognized from its contrary, and often states are recognized from the subjects that exhibit them. For A, if good condition is known, bad condition also becomes known, and B, good condition is known from the things that are in good condition, and they from it. If good condition is firmness of flesh, it is necessary both that bad condition should be flabbiness of flesh, and that the wholesome should be that which causes firmness in flesh. And it follows, for the most part, that if one contrary is ambiguous, the other also will be ambiguous, e.g., if just is so, that unjust will be so too. Now, justice and injustice seem to be ambiguous. But because their different meanings approach near to one another, the ambiguity escapes notice and is not obvious as it is. Comparatively, when the meanings are far apart, e.g., for here the difference in outward form is great, as the ambiguity in the use of kleis for the collarbone of an animal and for that with which we lock a door. Let us take, as a starting point then, the various meanings of an unjust man. Both the lawless man and the grasping and unfair man are thought to be unjust, so that evidently both the law-abiding and the fair man will be just. The just, then, is the lawful and the fair. The unjust, the unlawful, and the unfair. Since the unjust man is grasping, he must be concerned with goods, not all goods, but those with which prosperity and adversity have to do, which, taken absolutely, are always good, but for a particular person are not always good. Now men pray for and pursue these things, but they should not, but should pray that the things that are good absolutely may also be good for them, and should choose the things that are good for them. The unjust man does not always choose the greater, but also the less in the case of things bad absolutely. But because the lesser evil is itself thought to be in a sense good, and graspingness is directed at the good, therefore he is thought to be grasping. And he is unfair, for this contains and is common to both. Since the lawless man was seen to be unjust, and the law-abiding man just, evidently all lawful acts are, in a sense, just acts. For the acts laid down by the legislative art are lawful, and each of these, we say, is just. Now the laws in their enactments on all subjects aim at the common advantage either of all, or of the best, or of those who hold power, or something of the sort. So that in one sense we call those acts just, that tend to produce and preserve happiness and its components for the political society. And the law bids us do both the acts of a brave man, e.g. not to desert our post, nor take to flight, nor throw away our arms, and those of a temperate man, e.g. not to commit adultery, nor to gratify one's lust, and those of a good-tempered man, e.g. not to strike another, nor to speak evil, and similarly with regard to the other virtues and forms of wickedness, commanding some acts and forbidding others, and the rightly framed law does this rightly, and the hastily conceived one less well. This form of justice, then, is complete virtue, but not absolutely, but in relation to our neighbour. And therefore justice is often thought to be the greatest of virtues, and neither evening nor morning star is so wonderful, and proverbially, injustice is every virtue comprehended. and it is complete virtue in its fullest sense, because it is the actual exercise of complete virtue. It is complete because he who possesses it can exercise his virtue not only in himself, but towards his neighbour also.